Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Greece's prime minister appointed a new finance minister. Moscow sent an envoy to Libya, but Muammar Gaddafi says he won't accept any settlement. And the relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan took a turn for the worse. Joining me in the studio for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, newlywed Yoki Driessen of the National Journal, Jill Doherty of CNN, and Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic magazine. Do join us 800-433-8850. Your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And congratulations.
Thanks very much.
Tell me about this new finance minister in Greece, whether changing the characters in play is going to make a big difference.
You know, what's fascinating to me about Greece right now is that when we look at all the political debate going on in our own country about the economy, about spending cuts, about what a future economy should look like, if you're a Republican or a Democrat, you could look to Greece and see the apocalyptic scenario you think your opponents are going to bring about. So if you're a Democrat, you look into Greece and say, if you slash social spending and you slash all the social welfare net, this is what you're going to have, people by the hundreds of thousands marching in the streets. If you're a Republican, you say to the Democrats, unless we get our budget under control, we'll have to eventually take these incredibly painful measures and this will be the outcome. So it's fascinating to me looking at it from here that either way, wherever you are on the spectrum, Greece is just kind of a disaster.
And these protests have turned violent, but where can they go now? Where can the people who are making these decisions about Greece's economy, they're being blamed by the Germans. The Germans are saying that the Greeks are simply not doing what has to be done. The Greeks are saying that the Germans are being too tough.
Right, and the sort of backstory there, it's the Germans and the French, actually, who see eye to eye on this, which is somewhat unusual. And it has to do as much with private bonds and the private sector as it does with government money. One issue is that the Germans are just tired and angry that the EU is bailing out country after country. They feel like we're responsible, we save money, and these insane, profligate, heavily drinking, you know, winos in Greece are driving the European economy off the tracks. So that's one part. The second part is Greek banks and French banks are being pressured by their own governments to roll over the debt, the bonds that those banks own that Greece doesn't have the money to repay right now. Because if the banks in Germany or France try to collect, that will basically drive Greece into default. So one issue is the governments are tired of it. One issue is this fight between, in their own country, the German government and the German banks, and in their own country, the French government and the French banks.
Jill Doherty.
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the overall implications of this, it's very serious, because essentially what they have to do is they have to come up with an austerity plan that will convince the EU to other European governments to give them the next tranche of this money that they need, and that's $170 billion. But unless they come up with that and they can convince people that they're really serious about it, they won't get that money. And then if they don't, what happens? You know, again, we're back to this disaster scenario potentially. In fact, I was reading one thing that said it could be a potential breakup of the Eurozone. And I talked to one senior diplomat here in Washington last night who said that is inconceivable. You know, I mean, that is really very serious if that were to happen. And the contagion effect is what everybody is worried about. Not only in Europe, you have Spain, Portugal, Ireland, who already are in difficult straits. Then the pressure on the euro, then the pressure on the United States at a point where the United States economy is not doing so well.
Jeffrey Goldberg.
You know, it seems to me that inconceivable that Greece will be allowed to default. The consequences are catastrophic. Watch on Monday, I'm proven wrong, but it seems as if they're going to figure out a way to keep this going. The interesting demonstrations to me, the Greek demonstrations are very interesting, and the violence obviously has deep meaning and is deeply problematic for the Greek government. But the demonstrations that I'm interested in are the demonstrations that haven't happened yet, which I would predict will happen at some point in Germany and France and places that are just tired of bailing out the poorer members of the Eurozone. We've seen this in Portugal now, in Spain, and right. Greece. The drain is huge. I was talking to a German official earlier this week about this, and he said, you know, the people in his country are frustrated by this. They're not out in the streets, but eventually they're going to say, why don't we just cut ties? Why are we, you know, they don't have the relationship. The Eurozone is not the United States of America. You know, we don't let California sink into the sea just because they can't manage their money. But I don't think people in Germany really care whether Greece slides into the Mediterranean or not.
But you heard Alan Greenspan this week talk about what could happen if Greece goes into default. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think, though, that Jill's point before about the contagion is kind of exactly right. I mean, that was underlying Greenspan's fears. It's underlying all these fears. I mean, Greece is one order of magnitude. Portugal is a different order of magnitude. And Spain is another order of several orders of magnitude beyond right. it. So the fear isn't so much Greece, you know, qua Greece. It's Greece, if that is a domino that leads to Portugal, if that's a domino that leads to Spain. I mean, the other one in that, you know, the acronym that they always use, PIGS, which is so funny,
yeah. Yeah.
Ireland being the fourth of them, which is also an enormous, enormous, enormous catastrophe and a huge economy. But Spain is the kind of, if Spain goes down, then the idea of the euro collapsing, which seems so unthinkable today, becomes a lot more thinkable.
Look, we know from 2008 how an infection in one corner of an economy can envelop the entire body.
And isn't it already infecting or affecting the U.S. stock market, Jill?
Well, I'm not an expert on this, but it seems that there is a lot of worry. And when worry, even if it's not, you know, realistically based for the in the market, it can affect things. So I think that, again, you know, the tenuous unity of Europe and where Europe is going, it's another subject, but even NATO and what NATO is capable, maybe we'll get to that later, capable of doing is another subject. And Turkey vis-a-vis the EU, there's a lot of difficulty in Europe right now defining itself and who's really part of the in crowd that can keep their economies together.
Jill's just made a fascinating point. I didn't think of this, but you know, we think of our country having a little bit of, sorry to use the word from the 70s, but a sort of malaise, you know, that there's this kind of feeling that, oh, we're China's rising and we're falling. But in Europe, they're having an identity crisis of the sort that they haven't had in many, many years. And Libya has underscored this, the impotence of NATO, the fact that right. it really can't exist without the U.S. Has caused a lot of deep thinking, and now you see economic impotence on top of that. It's going to be a very interesting summer.
An interesting summer is the way to put it. Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic Magazine. He's also the author of Prisoners, A Story of Friendship and Terror. Jill Daugherty is foreign affairs correspondent for the National Journal Magazine, and foreign affairs correspondent for CNN, Yoki Driessen is with National Journal. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850, send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Jill Daugherty, what's the latest on attacks by government forces around Syria?
Oh, boy. I mean, where do we start? The stories that are coming out are really horrific. You have, you know, use of live ammunition. These are all allegations in a way, although everybody believes it, because it's very hard, almost impossible for the media to get in there. But they are, the government, we believe, is using live ammunition against citizens, rounding people up, rounding men up around the country, complete intimidation. There have been these reports recently of new towns where the Syrian tanks have been surrounding the entire town. And it's a desperate situation. The latest, important, Diane, the latest figures coming out of the State Department were close to 9,000 people fleeing from Syria into Turkey, and that's creating another issue.
1,400 Syrians reported killed by Syrian forces, civilians, 300 soldiers, and police killed, Jeffrey.
We don't know.
We don't
know. I mean, this
know.
Is so hard.
Those
I mean, we
are
see,
reports.
We get these shaky videos off people's cell phones that somehow they manage to upload onto YouTube, but we have no idea. We hear reports of using helicopter gunships against cities. Of course, there's precedent for this. One of the reasons that this is believable is that the current president's father, the late Hafez al-Assad, killed somewhere north of 20,000 people in a single Syrian town that was under the sort of influence of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hama. So this is a regime that is willing to go to any lengths to protect itself. And the important thing to note, I think, you know, those people who are thinking the Syrian regime is on its last legs, is that we haven't seen this sort of uprising in the two largest cities in Syria, Damascus and Aleppo. And if it stays out of there, maybe Aleppo is touched a little bit, but the Syrian forces allied with Assad seem to be doing a fairly rigorous job of suppression.
How is Turkey responding to this influx of refugees, Yoki?
I mean, part of it, frankly, is that Turkey is just looking at what's going on all of its borders with a great sense of alarm. I mean, 9,000 people, 10,000 people for Turkey, a huge country whose economy is doing extraordinarily well, is not that big of a risk. Their concerns have to do with who these 10,000 people are. I mean, are there going to be Kurdish people in there from, as it was the case in Syria, to fuel violence, but they're just looking around them and are terrified.
Yoki Driesen of National Journal. When we come back, we'll talk more. Take your calls. Stay with us. Welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup. This week with Jill Daugherty, foreign affairs correspondent for CNN, Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic Magazine, Yoki Driesen of National Journal. Want to go back to Syria. What is the world community able to do about Syria? Anything, Jill?
Well, right now, if you talk to the administration, they will say, we talk about this at the State Department every day at the briefing, they're taking economic and political steps. Economic meaning sanctions. They're trying to encourage others to implement sanctions as well. But there is really a problem, and it has to do with Libya, because when the United Nations passed that resolution to take military action to protect civilians in Libya, they had the support of many countries, including Russia and China. Well, actually, they abstained. The Russia abstained. But essentially, they were all on board. But since then, that operation has gone way beyond what Russia and China want. Therefore, they're digging in their heels on doing much about Syria. There are also economic issues as well. But right now, there is no cohesion there. And you heard from the State Department yesterday this message to China and Russia. You're seeing the same picture that we are. Do something.
Yeah, okay.
You know, Libya, I mean, this will sound obvious and cliche, but it matters. I mean, Libya is not Syria in any way, shape, or form. Right after the Libya operation began, the Treasury Department did a big press release that then had a glowing Washington Post story the following day about how they had frozen $33 billion of Gaddafi's money overnight, and it was the biggest seizure ever. Then when the Syria stuff kicked up, the question to them was, well, what have you frozen of Syria? And the answer was, some money here, some money there. The reason why they didn't do a similar press release is that Assad is smart, and Assad had virtually no money of any kind, either his family's, his close allies in here. U.S. banks. So that is off the table. Then you look at the military operation. NATO went into Libya. U.S. kind of was dragged to it by France and Britain with the understanding that this would be short, quick, easy. It's not. I mean, NATO warplanes are now strafing. There are NATO gunships, which are, for the most part, mainly American helicopters and gunships. But the NATO operation in Libya has been, so far, it's failed. So there's absolutely no one in the Pentagon, no one, who's looking at Syria, which has a relatively strong army, a relatively strong air force, and thinking, yeah, Libya's gone so well. Let's go do this in a big, strong country.
And explain, Jeffrey, about the gay girl in Damascus. What's it all about?
I have no idea what it's all about. What's the saying in journalism? Three's a trend, and we've had two, I think, so far, two instances of male bloggers making believe that they are lesbians. and in this case, this had a sort of a semi-tragic overlay, because there was this belief that this imaginary lesbian Syrian blogger was kidnapped by the Syrian forces, and then it emerged that it was a fiction. And of course, this was very dispiriting to a lot of the Syrian resistance. I'm not really an expert on men who make believe that they're lesbian Syrian bloggers, so I can't offer much psychological insight.
Yogi can.
I don't know.
How serious was this?
Yeah, I think it's serious only in the sense that there is real tragedy in Syria. I mean, there is real daily tragedy, and there's real daily bravery. I mean, for people, if you're a young Syrian and you know that Assad, like his father, has no compunction whatsoever to open up with tanks, with gunships, with mercenaries, and you still go to the streets, that's bravery. And when those stories are discredited by having this bizarre American living in Scotland who fakes he's a blogger, has a girlfriend who thinks he's real, he's posting on a blog whose editor also turns out to be a man pretending to be a lesbian blogger. So it's, on the one hand, it's kind of, we can laugh at it because it's funny and it's absurd. On the other hand, it obscures the daily tragedy of young people in the streets of Syria being
gunned down. It says a lot about the internet, obviously.
Yeah,
you can
clearly.
Sort of make believe you're anything you want to be.
You know, on the other hand, once we sort of knew, why did this story get so much coverage, Jill?
Well, I mean, number one, it's kind of interesting, you know, that it turns out to be a man. But also, she, in quotes, was talking about life in Syria, you know, politically and personally. And her story was really compelling, from a rich family, politically connected. It was very
detailed. Like much fiction. It was very compelling.
It was. But I think, Diane, there is another point to this, which is, throughout the Arab Spring, a lot of this, as we know so well, has been pushed really through the social media. So when you have a blog in the social media that is fake, it undermines some of the belief that people might have in what is really real. And it opens up the potential for the government of Syria to say, look, we told you they're lying about us, and here's a good example. Mm.
And let's turn now to Pakistan, where very serious stuff is going on. Pakistan arrested five CIA informants this week.
So they say, yeah.
So they say,
including at least one army officer, a major, I believe. This is every week, this cycles in a very interesting way. Every week we hear, sort of at the beginning of the week, well, we're on the road to repair the relations with Pakistan, and then boom, you get slammed toward a couple of days later, and you hear that Pakistani informants had alerted al-Qaeda people to a coming American operation. You hear stories about these people being arrested for being informants to the Americans. The most consequential thing going on in Pakistan this week is that the army chief, who is the most powerful person in the country, more powerful than the president, might be on his way out, because he is seen, and this might provoke some sort of incredulous reaction in America, he is seen as being too pro-American. The officer corps in Pakistan is relentlessly now, relentlessly and harshly anti-American, and he is seen as a bit of a kowtower. And if he goes, well, that will be certainly a lesson to any Pakistani general or Pakistani officer that cooperation with America comes really at the cost of your career.
I thought it was fascinating to hear outgoing Defense Secretary Bob Gates testifying before Congress this week on this particular aspect of how everybody lies, how governments lie to each other.
Yeah, I mean, and it's important to keep some perspective on all this. I mean, America arrests its own spies all the time. I mean, if we had, you know, the Pollard case is an obvious example, but if there's an American spying on behalf even of a friendly government, they'll be arrested. So it's not so surprising that Pakistan would arrest people spying on behalf of a foreign government.
But most they were spying on a target that the Pakistani government had asserted it was also looking for.
But it still doesn't matter. I mean, for a country that's so concerned about sovereignty, it doesn't matter. It functionally doesn't matter. But with Kiani, I think the fundamental question is, it's a devil you know versus the devil you don't know. I mean, the tone of a lot of the coverage this week has been, if Kiani goes, it's such a tragedy for the U.S. In point of fact, Kiani over the last couple of years has done nothing for the U.S., nothing. In 2008, 2009, he approved drone strikes in a way that had not been approved before. He ordered an operation into parts of Waziristan on a scale that Pakistan had never done before. And so there's a hope that would continue. I mean, North Waziristan is the target that the U.S. had been hoping for years he'd order his forces into. He hasn't. The U.S. has repeatedly asked for permission to expand drone operations further into Pakistan. He's rejected them cold. So it's alarming that he's seen as so pro-American. That's the reason he may be thrown out. But it's not something where this is such a great ally of ours that if he were to go, suddenly we would take such a huge hit. He's, if anything, like Pakistan, like the rest of the country, at best he's an uncertain ally, and at worst he's actively doing little to help us in a fight that would benefit Pakistan if it succeeded.
And there were questions to Admiral Mullen as to what would happen if the U.S. simply walked away from Pakistan, Jill.
Right. And you know, the administration says they simply cannot walk away. There is no way that the United States is going to walk away. But how do you manage this relationship? And I was speaking with one State Department official who made an interesting point that I think sometimes we forget, is that they have domestic politics just as the United States does. And right now you have a bad combination because they are smarting, you know, the military in Pakistan are smarting from what happened during the Osama bin Laden operation, feeling that they have been, that their honor has been besmirched, and also angry at the Americans. And then you have the debate here in the United States, you know, over military action almost any place, name it. But that domestic component in Pakistan is crucial, and it's not always recognized by American legislators.
What about the future of the U.S. drone program in Pakistan?
It's not going anywhere. I mean, Kiani may well take a step that he's hinted he's going to take, and it's now, at least in the circles I talked to, it's expected it will happen soon, where there's a CIA base in Pakistan that's used exclusively for drone operations that has been closing down in part because of pressure from the Pakistanis. There's an expectation that he'll formally order that base to be closed down, which would be fairly significant. On the other hand, as we saw with the bin Laden raid, the benefit of having bases sprinkled all throughout eastern Afghanistan is you can fly those exact same drones over the border from Afghanistan without any problem. So closing that base would be a blow, primarily a symbolic one, and it's expected it's going to happen. It's not going to stop the drones from flying. It's not going to stop the CIA from targeting and using missiles to kill people they feel they can kill.
You want to hear an irony. The irony is that we might have to stay in Afghanistan so we could operate against Pakistan. Think about where we were 10 years ago, using Pakistan as a launching pad into Afghanistan, and now we're going to have to run our drone strikes against Al-Qaeda, which is mainly
in Pakistan.
Because we, you know, pushed them there, obviously. So it's no way out.
Okay, and somebody who's trying to find a way out of Libya is a Moscow envoy. What's Moscow doing in Libya?
Well, number one, they kind of want to get their name out there. And I actually know Mikhail Margalef quite well. He's a canny man, and he has been there. Essentially, what he is saying is okay, we don't like, President Medvedev does not, at this point, believe that Gaddafi should stay in power. However, Margalef is splitting it by saying, well, he can get out of power, but he could physically stay in Libya. And the opposition, the TNC, the Transition National Council, says no way, that, in fact, Gaddafi staying in Libya is Gaddafi staying in power. He has to go.
But didn't Gaddafi say, we'll have national elections?
His son, Saif, said that. Saif is raising that. And, of course, that came up at the briefing at the State Department yesterday and was royally shot down within 2 seconds. So nobody believes that there will be any elections. And the sad, perhaps, point about this is that you just have Gaddafi essentially thumbing his nose at the international community, saying, here I am. And the debate here in Washington over over all of this and the role of the United States in Libya, the air attacks, et cetera, is just fueling that. I mean, Gaddafi, you know, watches TV. He can see what's going on.
So there's War Powers Act being debated.
It's actually interesting. You mentioned Gaddafi watches TV. I wonder if he watched the Republican debate a few nights ago, because you saw a level of uncertainty rather than muscularity that you usually come to expect from Republican candidates for president. There was critics would call it squishiness, and others would call it a kind of a little tone of isolationism creeping in. You know, we've reached our breaking point. We can't be involved in so many countries at once. And so you have now the Speaker of the House who argued when he was a mere member of Congress against the War Powers Act, now demanding that President Obama adhere to the War Powers Act, go to Congress to get a declaration of war. And the Obama administration has come with this kind of very legalistic argument that we're not really at war because we don't have boots on the ground. It's a very interesting debate, and the Obama administration might lose this debate.
And, of course, President Obama himself was on the other side of that War Powers argument when he was in the Senate. What about the fact that NATO warplanes are attacking Libya today in broad daylight?
I mean, I think that the more clarity and honesty, the whole Libya campaign from the start has been shrouded in a level of Orwellian just sort of double talk. I mean, it's everyone knows that it's about Gaddafi. Everyone. He knows it. The rebels know it. Our government knows it. But we couldn't say that. We kept saying it wasn't about Gaddafi. Now we're trying to bomb and kill Gaddafi, and that's, at least it's honest.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones at this point. 800-433-8850. First to Germantown, Maryland. Good morning, Ted. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is basically, why do you think it is that the people of Greece are having such an extreme reaction to these austerity measures? And I'm wondering why we didn't see such an extreme reaction from people here in the U.S. when the Wall Street bailouts were going on.
You know, the second half of that's a really good question. I mean, it's amazing to me, actually, that there was not more public rage, and even, not that I'm in any way encouraging this, but that there wasn't some sort of violent reaction towards Wall Street, given the enormity of the bailout. But Greece has had a history of violent political violence, mostly left-wing political violence, going back decades. You've had firebombings and faction, you know, the various communist-linked factions in the 70s and 80s. Greece is sort of a special case in that respect. But I think the question of why is it that we don't have it here is interesting. And you wonder, during the election, given that the bailouts are unpopular with Republicans and with Democrats, if you won't see this become more of an issue than it had been in the past.
Interesting. Jeffrey.
And let's keep in mind, even in 2008, even in the worst of this, we've never approached what Greece is experiencing. Greece, 16% unemployment right now, much higher among young people, college grads. I mean, yes, we all understand that people graduating from college here right now are having a difficult time finding work. Greek kids, Greek college graduates are in a state of despair. And, of course, that is the despair of young people on the streets is what creates this chaos.
Jill.
Also, I think it's a different situation because in Greece you have a government really on the ropes, you know, now about to default. In the United States, the government was not going to default. It was still kind of cranking a lot. Well, I mean, actually, Maybe in retrospect, it was. It could have. But it was not perceived that the government had essentially just kind of fallen apart, had no, the profligate way that it was in Greece behaving. The situation is much more dire in Greece.
Well, and you've got this, you've got this debate here going on about raising the debt level. You've got what's happening in Greece. I mean, aren't they feeding each other in one sense?
Definitely. And, there's a wonderful phrase in economics of opportunity cost. And right now, there's a huge opportunity cost that we're suffering because investors all over the world who are looking at Europe and are terrified would love to find a safe place to put their money. And usually, historically, that safe place has been the U.S. And it's not happening right now because they're afraid we're going to default. Or at least come close to a default.
Yoki Driesen of National Journal Magazine. We'll take a short break here. And when we come back, more of your calls, your emails, your tweets, your postings on Facebook.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kauffman Foundation, working to grow economies and expand human welfare. Learn more at kauffman.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Nick Cave talks about writing dark songs about love and death. Four albums by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds have just been reissued. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup. A number of you have written to ask about Saudi women defying the rules against driving. Big deal, but it happens fairly regularly. And still, Saudi women not allowed to drive, Jill.
Yeah, and I think, it's part of, basically, as I understand it, it's an online movement to get women out. And I believe today is a day that they're supposed to hit the streets. We'll have to see the reporting coming out of there. But, I think it's all part of this. Certainly there's women's rights, but there is that movement in the region for people not to be dissed by their government or by their society. And it does sometimes run up against Islamic law or what's perceived as Islamic law. But it's truly, I think, a grassroots movement for people who want to be respected. And it could have implications for women's rights.
For women's rights.
Speeding it up.
Yeah.
Not just women, but people in general are taking to the streets because they want to be respected. They want their rights as human beings.
Of course. Part of the Arab Spring, Jeffrey.
Part of the Arab Spring. Everything feeds off of each other. On the other hand, to say that we're seeing an incipient women's rights movement in Saudi Arabia might be premature. I mean, women can't vote. Of course, no one can vote. It's technically illegal for a woman to be outside without being accompanied by a husband or a brother or a father. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's what driving is just a symptom of a deeper desire on the part of Saudi society and religious leadership to keep women literally locked up at home.
All right. But Diane, could I just say one more thing? Because today, in fact, just this morning, here's another example of how things are changing so quickly. The UN Human Rights Council in Geneva took a vote just a few hours ago on a resolution on gay rights, and it was led by South Africa. Now, there were a lot of African countries that were not happy with that, but that's an indication of how quickly things are going because
exactly.
The U.S. pushed, and at one point they were thinking, well, maybe it won't happen, but it actually did.
All right, let's go to Greensboro, North Carolina. Good morning, Donnie.
Good morning, Diane. My question is, the economic problems that we have going on inside the United States, and, you know, they're pulling money away from programs like Medicare, Medicaid to try to balance the budget and things like that. What are we doing as far as government aid to other countries? For instance, Pakistan, I know we send a large amount of money to them every year for whatever they use it for. But knowing that they have one of the largest nuclear weapons programs growing over there, you know, it seems like why would we be financing them if they can afford to build nuclear weapons? Why are we giving them money?
Jeffrey.
All good questions, all good questions, and the answer is frustrating. The answer, we can look into recent history in the relationship between Pakistan and the U.S. We used Pakistan as a base against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. We spent billions and billions of dollars there. When we won that war in 1989, we abandoned Pakistan. Essentially, we said, thank you very much, we're leaving now. All those jihadists, the mujahideen who we were supporting, many of them migrated into groups like Al-Qaeda. And then in 2001, we got bit, essentially, by this monster. We didn't create it. But our desire to step back from Pakistan and Afghanistan in such a dramatic way had serious consequences. It allowed this thing to grow. So by not supporting countries like Pakistan, by not supporting them, by not helping the militaries, we could be creating situations 10, 15 years down the road when we have an even bigger problem. They have nuclear weapons, you're right, and that's a good reason to stay engaged, because we want those nuclear weapons in the hands of sane people, and there's so many extremists there, and we have to be there in order to make sure that they don't fall into the hands of the next generation of international jihadists.
All right, to Hanover, New Hampshire. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning. I'm calling because it seems to me, both in terms of the Arab Spring and the Eurozone issues, particularly with Greece, possibly Ireland and Portugal, that more than ever, the interdependence of people, both politically and certainly economically, is coming to the fore. And I certainly think that economics and unemployment has had something to do with the Arab Spring, as well as with the problems the Eurozone's having within itself, as well as our own domestic issues. How can we learn that this isn't just another recession, albeit severe, but that we are precipitously close to a worldwide depression? And why can't we, since we are interdependent, learn to, and how can we, collaborate rather than go to adversarial modes of being, whether it's within nations, among nations, or, for example, the Democratic and Republic leadership of our own country?
Okay.
It's a great question that I wish I was smart enough to answer as well as it was asked. Two points that I would make. One is that it is doubtlessly true that the economy is fueling the Arab Spring in two directions. I mean, if we think back to how this all started back when it was still a story of hope in some ways, rather than what it currently is, where there's blood and tanks shooting on their own people, et cetera. But it was an unemployed man, effectively, in Tunisia who had, I mean, it's something like out of a movie, like a Fellini movie, but he had a fruit stand. The fruit stand was taken away by a corrupt government, so he killed himself, and that fueled it. But what you're seeing in places where there's not the kind of mass support, like in Syria, is that the middle class doesn't want to take part in this. The Syrian middle class feels like its interests, its economic interests, are best protected by Assad. So it's true both on both halves of the coin, both sides of the coin. In the street are people who are suffering economically, supporting the governments where they still have support are those doing well. And that's, in some ways, that disconnect economically is what's fueling the disconnect politically.
Before we take another call, I want to ask you about reports that President Saleh plans to return to Yemen in days. What are you hearing, Jill?
That is a report. And if he were to return, you know, he was injured in an attack along with a number of members of his government. And he is in the hospital in Saudi Arabia. If he is to return, it could be very serious because already the destabilization has taken place. It's Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, that is one of the strongest and most virulent strains of Al-Qaeda is found in Yemen. And they are taking some aggressive action already. It's a great concern for the United States. And when President Saleh left, he has his vice president in charge. The vice president had actually been in some type of communication with the opposition. That was perceived as being positive. Hmm. If he comes back, there is grave concern that this could really spiral downward. That country is almost a failed state, and it could be really disastrous.
I mean, not to make life something very serious, but with everything related to Saleh, we have to take it with a shaker of salt, because this morning, first on Twitter was, he's never coming back. Then it was a short time later, he's coming back. Then it was, he's not coming back. Then it's coming back. I mean, this is all just this morning. And the honest truth is, no one knows. I mean, the Saudis who are close to him and close, the Saudis will openly admit if you talk to them, they don't know what he's going to do. And they're the ones who have funded him and kept him in power for decades. And it's this weird story. I mean, we were joking about this online earlier in the day, but you know, the Anthony Weiner resignation watch of he's going, he's not going, he's going, he's not going. This is the dark, horrible, violent version of that, and the honest truth is no one knows.
Yeah, no, I was saying Anthony Weiner could take lessons in tenacity from this guy. This guy would win the Nobel Prize for tenaciousness and also obtuseness, because I think Yemen has moved beyond him, and so there's some hope, and no one knows, as Jill points out. There's no good outcome here because Yemen is a country, among other things, without water. By the way, it has a catastrophic lack of water now. But we're dealing with a country that is not going to be stabilized by the return of this man.
All right, let's go back to the phones. West Palm Beach, Florida. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Diane. I'd like to revisit a conversation we had about the possibility, caller brought up, possibility of the United States becoming a Greece in a violent way. It was kind of stated that we didn't think so, one of your panelists said, because we had gone through our worst in 2008. I kind of took issue with that in my mind because unemployment has almost doubled since 2008. Our national debt has almost tripled. And I'll be honest, I am concerned. I'm not going to say afraid, but I am concerned about this getting to the point where our creditors, like Yoki had mentioned, looking at the United States possibly becoming insolvent and then us taking to the streets. I'd like to revisit that.
I mean, it's a really interesting question because you could argue that what's fueling the Tea Party, both the Tea Party and the sort of mainstream of it, but also the fringe parts of it that have been actively violent or supportive of violence, you can argue that that's economic as much as it is anything else, that it's concern about the debt as the obvious level, but also concern about take your hands off my Medicare, take your hands off my, your government hands off my Medicare, this belief that Medicare is different, but government spending is out of control. I would not be surprised at all, just given, I mean, the Tea Party as a movement is obviously, it's not extremist across the board. It's not racist across the board, obviously. But there's an element on its fringe which is. And that element is angry. And that element, as we've seen in the Giffords case and other cases, that element is perfectly willing to use violence. Mm. It's not clear to me that we're going to see mass protests, but I agree with the caller. There's a serious issue and there's real fury in much of the country about it.
Thanks for calling, Robert. Now to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, John. John.
Yes, good. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Yes. Hi. I would like to make a comment about what your learned panel said about the European crisis, which I understand is they're basically repeating, you know, some very commonly repeated places and about the crisis. First of all, that very demeaning acronym of PIGS, in which everybody puts together Greece, Portugal, Ireland and Spain, as if they were the same economies and the same countries. It's just look at the GDP of Greece, which is 32 in the world, Portugal 38th, and Ireland 43rd. Spain is number 12 economy in the world, only in front of them, you know, China, Japan, United Kingdom, Brazil, Italy, Canada. And the EEC is the fourth economy, and the GDP is it's double Portugal, Ireland, and Greece all combined. So people have to stop repeating nonsensical data, which has no economical backing. Spain is a modern country with the largest high-speed rail system in the world, with the highest green electricity combination of resources in the world. And Spain is not going to default.
Absolutely correct. I would have to agree. I mean, I think we were shorthanding it. And the main concern, again, is the possibility of contagion. And some countries, you know, Spain and Ireland and, you know, the other countries, Portugal, do have economic problems. There's no getting away from that. But I totally take the point of the caller.
Jill Tardy of CNN, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Clearwater, Florida. Joanne, you're on the air.
Good morning. All reports are saying that the United States relationship with Pakistan is at its lowest since the 2001 terror attack, when Pakistan agreed to be partners in the war against terror. In my opinion, is that the relationship has been lopsided from the get-go. And despite all the praise that our government has been giving Pakistan, the proof is that the U.S. couldn't even divulge the plans for the operation at the compound where bin Laden was hiding out. And my opinion is that Pakistan has been in it for the money. Not only that, look at the blood money that the United States paid for those boys that were killed in the NATO attacks. And now I'm just kind of waiting to see what the outcome is going to be of those five Pakistanis that have been arrested for feeding the information to the CIA, if all these reports that we're hearing are true.
Jill.
I guess I'd ask, what would the, you know, our listener want to do as a result of all of that? You know, some of her points are valid in some cases, but what do you do? Pull the plug? There is no way, because Pakistan is crucial to fighting terrorism.
I mean, it's also the case that of the five, I mean, the reports this morning were that at least three have already been released, possibly as many as four of the five have been released. Yeah, but it's very easy to bash Pakistan, and in many cases they deserve it. But it's also worth trying to put ourselves in their heads as much as we can. I mean, if only to understand why it is they're behaving in ways that we find so baffling. They genuinely see India as a threat. I mean, it's not simply that they use this as lip service. They do as well. But I've spent a lot of time there. My colleagues spent a lot of time there. Pakistanis hate India. They fear India. They see conspiracies all around them. It's the most conspiratorially minded place I've ever been to, even more so than the Middle East. And they see at the center of those conspiracies some combination of the Hindu-Zionist American conspiracy. They believe it's the U.S. teaming with India, teaming with Israel. And again, whether that's rational or irrational, it's how they feel. So bashing them is one thing, but we need to understand somewhat as a country why it is they act the way they do, and that's the reason.
You know, Joanne is speaking from the heartland in many ways of this issue. I think she represents what many people in Congress feel about this issue. But I have to agree with my panelists, with fellow panelists, that we make this mistake by mirror imaging. We talk about this in intelligence work a lot, that just because we would react a certain way to a situation doesn't mean that the Pakistanis are going to react in a certain way. They do have domestic politics, as Jill pointed out, and the domestic politics are such that many politicians and generals who understand the necessity of a relationship with America can't go out to the voters and say that, because they will lose their standing.
Finally, what do we know about the successor to Osama bin Laden, Yoki?
You know, he's exactly what he is the person everyone expected him to be. What's been funny to my mind is the sort of interesting quasi-passive-aggressive ways in which U.S. officials have made clear that this is exactly who they hoped it would be. Secretary Gates yesterday said that bin Laden had peculiar charisma, which was a phrase I really liked. That's Zawahiri lacked. I mean, there's been a sort of feeling that bin Laden had a popularity that Zawahiri can't match, and that net-net, if you eliminate not only the spiritual figurehead, the financier, the kind of person who is running it in every sense of the word, and replace him with a person who isn't liked, and who's an Egyptian, when there's a clash in al-Qaeda between Arabs and non-Arabs, that net-net, that's a good thing for the U.S.
The interesting thing about, one of the many interesting things about Zawahiri is that even in al-Qaeda, we get reports that he's thought of as an unpleasant man. Now, if you're an al-Qaeda terrorist and you're looking at someone and thinking, wow, that guy's a little bit harsh, you're dealing with a serious problem.
Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic magazine, Yoki Driesen of National Journal, Jill Doherty of CNN, thank you all so much. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Katie June Friesen answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales.